call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, February 28, 2007. Members, we have three bills set for initial public hearing today, and at this point, we've only located, they're all member-sponsored bills, and we've only been able to connect with one of the member sponsors at this point, so we're going to go directly to that bill, which is House Bill 2463. I'll circle back then to see if there are a member or other proponent available on the other bills to hear them, but we'll begin with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2463. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2463 comes to you from Representative Butler, allows a county, city, or local service district to petition for bankruptcy protection under the federal bankruptcy laws. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, federal law is such that a local government entity cannot avail themselves of the federal bankruptcy laws unless state law allows them to do so, because local government entities are a creature of the state, and federal law, federal constitutional law, requires that permission.
Thank you, Council. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. House Bill 2463 comes about as a result of a number of issues that have been concerning local and municipal governments recently and over the past number of years. Because of the constraints of Measures 5 and 50, the cost of operating local government cannot be supported by tax, and of course with the potential of the loss of the O&C monies from the Federal Forest Safety Net monies under Public Law 106-393, we have local governments, particularly counties, who are in very desperate straits. I don't think it's any secret to those members of your committee that that there are, in certain circumstances around the state of Oregon, counties presently who are just barely getting by, and with the loss of the O&C monies and the inability to raise taxes through property tax or through levy because of the constraints of compression on the tax system, these folks just do not have any other alternatives that are reasonable alternatives that are available to them. Presently, in the Revenue Committee, in your Revenue Committee in the House, we're discussing bills to continue to allow road departments to maybe be able to sustain themselves with additional local registration fees charged by the Department of Motor Vehicles and then passed through additional registration fees that would be charged and then passed through to the counties to take care of their road funds in supporting road activities. But that does not continue to operate local government in the forms that we need to see them to be able to operate jails and so forth. One possibility will be that we'll probably see some attempts to consolidate counties, particularly those counties which just do not have any other alternative but to consolidate, but that really that spreads the poison around amongst a larger area and a larger number of people and may sustain it for some period of time. The other issue isn't just counties being potentially in default with regard to some of their obligations, but would also local districts, small towns and local districts. I have the unfortunate experience in House District 60 to have some irrigation districts and some water districts that I cannot get people to run for the boards because the boards cannot raise enough money to buy the tort insurance and the liability insurance that they need to protect the officers and directors. Thus, some irrigation and wastewater districts have remained without boards of directors, without anyone to do the day-to-day activity for virtually years and years, and two particular cases, in the high area of the watershed, we've got folks that have huge PERS assessments as a result of employee health issues, having one or two employees and having one of them get sick and eventually retire under PERS under the old system, where they can draw on the system for long-term health care and retirement issues has left some of those irrigation districts to the point where their assessment rate is over 100% with regard to the needs that they have to be able to support that. I also have a small town in House District 60 that's faced with the same thing, a PERS rate that they can't afford to hire a clerk, even a city clerk, has to be basically by conscript, in effect, from the city to get someone to help with the water plant and open and close the bills and those kinds of things. So this is becoming a reality. We noticed in California, particularly in Orange County, that they weren't able to avail themselves of the federal bankruptcy code years ago, and California had to adopt this. It sounds like a defeatist attitude, but Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we need to have a true operation of law available to these folks so that they can bail out when the time comes and be able to resolve their debts, even if they have to end up consolidating eventually the assets so that we can get multiple districts to go together or multiple towns. Again, when a town folds, and I have had cities in Mount Hare County actually have to fold up, then it leaves the streets and any infrastructure that's left to the county to have to support that, and heaven forbid that you have to have your county commissioners go out and run a water or sewer treatment plant. It becomes a terrible situation, and we just have to be able to provide for who is going to, or how these folks can orderly add up the assets and subtract the liabilities and pay their debts and go on with business.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, are you going to be at the meeting this evening at 5:30 in room 350 regarding the timber revenue that Gary Hansen is putting together?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I was not previously invited to that meeting. I'll have to check my calendar, but some of the counties which I represent have rather significant involvement in the federal forest safety net. The principal county that I represent, the largest single county with regard to population, Mount Hare County, only received a very small amount under that federal forest safety net. But I also recognize that with the defunding of the Deficit Reduction Act, that there's a pretty good possibility that payments in lieu of taxes will be affected, and that affects all counties where we have 70% and 80% publicly owned property.
I want to make sure we got that out, because that meeting is today at 5:30 in room 350. And really, every legislator should be there, whether you have a district or not that's affected, because it's going to affect, I believe, the entire state of Oregon. We have an opinion coming now as a result of Curry County asking us, hey, what happens if we go bankrupt? What is the state? How does the state take over some of this if we just walk away and close the doors? They're asking possibly going to put up a $4 million levy down there to replace those funds in Curry County. But you talked about consolidation. They've talked to Josephine County. Well, they're not in good shape, and they aren't going to want Curry County. We're even in worse shape. You talked to Coos County, the other part of my district. They don't want Curry County because we're in worse shape than they are. And so we've got a huge problem coming up here. And even if they were to get some of this timber money in May, they're already got the pink slips. People are being laid off. You're going to see drop in enrollment in the schools. That means the schools are going to be in trouble trying to finance it. And this thing is going to be a real mess. And I think part of the idea today in 350, that room, Gary Hansen is going to bring the right people together to make us understand what is really going to happen and who's going to be affected. What are all the different services that are going to go away? And what are we constitutionally required to do as a state?
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, thank you very much for your foresight in bringing this forth. I have a couple of questions. Do we also need to look at school districts, ESD districts, or because you talked about PERS and things like that? And also a follow-up, Representative Butler's. This is great foresight on your part. Where's the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties and the other lobbyists to help you and help be sure these things are looked at as we face these crises in the near future?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Wisnant, thank you for the question. School districts could certainly avail themselves if House Bill 2463 were part of the law. However, I would hope that those folks with the state funding would be able to continue to access some funds available through the Department of Education, but also the state has gone through various consolidations of school districts. That's not a bad thing. We found that there are some savings in the economies of scale. And again, I don't want to be a defeatist in this process and to tell you that Curry County just goes away. It doesn't just go away. We'll still have obligations to the folks, to our constituents in Curry County, just as we will in Jackson, Josephine, and Coos County. They're still Oregonians, and the fact that we've got a defective permanent tax base as a result of Measure 50 doesn't mean that we can just turn our heads and say, well, shame on them for not planning 15 years ago to try and take care of some of these issues when the ONC monies were coming in, or that in the May 20th, 1997 passage of Measure 50, which will soon be 10 years old, that it doesn't deserve to be returned to the voters in Oregon for a constitutional fix. But in that meantime, I think we've got to look at reality and allow people some opportunity to order their financial lives in these counties and cities and special districts as to how they will resolve their issues. But certainly schools are affected as well, and we hope that we'll be able to find ways for those folks to consolidate districts and without any interruption in education.
Representative Kopp.
Thanks, Chair. Representative Butler. Been dealing with Burley and Buckley too much. But I thank you for seriously bringing this forward. And because you have an expertise that I don't have, could you paint me a little more detail on your picture? Let's say a city goes bankrupt. As a person, I write a check every month to pay for my water bill and sewer bill. So what would it look like or feel like to me as a regular constituent if my city went bankrupt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, and certainly I would defer to those legal minds that understand this much better than I do, but under the federal bankruptcy laws, first of all, you've got to figure out what the total amounts of liabilities are, what the total assets look like. And of course, for a city, the asset would probably look like this. If you've got a city hall, that's an asset, and that city hall could go on the chopping block at that particular point. If you've got a sewer and water infrastructure plant, then I'm going to guess that's an asset. And there's typically with small towns in Oregon today, most of those small plants who have had to increase their capacity, increase their efficiency as a result of environmental obligations that we continue to have forced upon us, I'm going to guess that they're not the kinds of plants that you could go out and say, well, today the city of, fill in the blank, is operating that plant. Tomorrow, the company of, fill in the blank, will be happy to start operating that plant, because they're not the kinds of things with those kinds of mandates and those kind of pushdowns that are typically best run by private industry. However, private industry certainly could be an alternative. And Oregon does have a number of water districts presently that are private water companies,
right,
that have subscribers to them that are operated under the auspices of the Public Utilities Commission and controlled by the Public Utilities Commission. So water and sewer could technically be continued on by some private portion. There would have to be some guarantees in that process. The guarantees would probably liquidate any of the assets. And I am concerned that we don't go around thinking that immediately water and sewer services are going to be cut off overnight. But I do believe that there needs to be an orderly way where those folks can marshal their assets, account for their liabilities, and then go back to the public and say, here are the choices, and then we add the potential of bankruptcy in as one of the choices. Presently, they don't have that alternative, and I do have a concern for the for where League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, they are concerned about this, but they're not defeatists either, but they do need to recognize that we need another arrow in the quiver, another tool in the toolbox, to say this is an alternative. And I don't relish the idea of having those services be put in jeopardy for any Oregonian that's depending upon them on a monthly pay basis.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Butler. In Orange County, when that was going on, I'm thinking the employees had the deferred compensation plans, 457s. And at that time, they said that money belonged to Orange County. It wasn't the employees' money. And it could go. Did they change a lot? Are you familiar with that? Have they changed a lot to protect the employees' money on those, or is that still part of the...
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Barker, I'm going to guess that probably under ERISA and other actions that have happened since the bankruptcy of Orange County, that employees are probably highly protected in that regard now. And certainly with regard to PERS, and please make no mistake about it, this does not mean that PERS or the beneficiaries of PERS are in any immediate jeopardy. The concern that we have is PERS doesn't even have a mechanism today that could deal with the bankruptcy of a small district, a small city or county or a small district. Basically their position is that if the city of or if the district of, and fill in the blank, folds, then what happens is that everybody else that are members of the public employee retirement system, all other and members include public members as well as the municipalities and other employing agencies themselves that are members of PERS, it's their position that everybody bears the risk of that. That's a legal question I'm not prepared to address, as far as I can see, no public employee and no retiree is at risk in this process. We just need an orderly, we just need to add one more device so that we could have an orderly discussion about what happens to the liabilities that are outstanding. And my guess is that with regard to any kinds of public employee retirement obligations, that the assets, the bulk of the assets would be used to fund and to fund your way out of those kinds of problems.
Actually, on that technical point, Representative Barker, as a result of the bankruptcy in Orange County, there was a federal law change to require 457 plans to have their assets held in trust, and that was enacted about a dozen years ago.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, is that part of ERISA then?
It was a change in the tax codes. It wasn't technically a change to the ERISA statute, but it's within that general federal statutory scheme. Any further questions? Representative Butler, thank you for bringing this bill. I think this is an important issue to be brought forward, and I appreciate your leadership on it.
Thank you, members of the
committee. Representative Dallum, you're here to present on House Bill 2450, right? So I'm going to recess, although I want to reopen in a moment the public hearing on House Bill 2463, but we'll close it here for the moment and open a public hearing on House Bill 2450. Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. For the record, Representative John Dallum, House District 59. And I'll give you a brief history. I attended a meeting in Grant County, and there was great concern about a large land purchase from another municipality. I submitted the legislation, and since that time, several other constituents have asked to visit with me about the legislation and would like to change some portions of it. So I'd respectfully ask that you table House Bill 2450 until I can hear from the balance of my constituents.
Okay, very good. I appreciate your stopping by to report to us on the status of that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Dallum. We had a number of other folks who had signed up to testify on House Bill 2450. In view of the what we, Representative Dahlin just explained about the status of the bill. Is there anyone who would like to come forward and present in the public hearing? I'm not seeing anybody coming forward then, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2450 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2463. And I'd like to invite Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities and Paul Snyder from the AOC, the counties, forward to comment. I realize that you didn't come prepared to present on this, but it is an important issue. And it's one that, if it were to be pursued, I think would have a lot of ramifications that would need to be explored. And anything you might share with us that would help us add to our understanding of the issues would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing right now in support of House Bill 2463. As Representative Butler and Representative Krieger and others have already pointed out very well, we've got some serious problems with respect to counties, and we're looking for as many tools in the tool chest as we can find. I did check some press releases with respect to Orange County, and from what I recall about what they said, and again, I didn't prepare in advance for this, Mr. Chair, but my recollection is that Orange County was advised by counsel to file for bankruptcy protections under Article 11, and one of the reasons for that was that there was a concern about a run on their debt in the markets by people who were frightened that they wouldn't get their money's worth out of it. And Orange County was in a situation where it had a pretty vital economy, and it didn't take it very long to get out of bankruptcy protections. I believe it took about 6 months. But with respect to the counties that we may need this protection for in Oregon, it may be a little bit different, but nonetheless, it's a valuable tool to have. And if we're not able to avail ourselves of that protection without a bill such as this, then we should have a bill such as this so we can do it.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Ms. Ludwig, did you have some comments?
Mr. Chair, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. We appreciate Representative Butler's concerns. However, the League does not have a position on this bill today. I have not heard from cities across the state that are looking for this type of protection or change in the law at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Realizing again, Mr. Snyder, that you hadn't prepared for this, but the idea is has a lot of levels of complexity in it, and when I start thinking about what it would mean for a county, for example, say one of our counties that's in serious distress over this because of the disappearance of these federal dollars upon which they've been depending. If they were to pursue bankruptcy, you know, without knowing just what the bankruptcy provision is that's referenced in this bill, in general, for private entities, there are two kinds of bankruptcies. One is a liquidation bankruptcy, where basically you sell off all the assets of the bankrupt and you settle out the debts pro rata, and the creditors get some only cents on the dollar, and the entity that was bankrupt disappears, or the individual, if it's an individual, is discharged from the remaining obligation. Or you have a reorganization bankruptcy where the creditors are in effect put on hold while there's a workout plan that under which they may get paid ultimately everything or maybe not everything, but they agree to take less. That's the general outline of the way private sector bankruptcies work. Do you have any sense, and I realize you're not prepared, and so you could just demur if you need to, but about how a bankruptcy of a county would work and what kind of obligations the counties would have, that this would be a useful mechanism to be able to respond to those obligations?
Mr. Chair, I'd be working from information that's so old that it's older than a lot of people in this room. In private practice, I used to do Section 7, Section 11 bankruptcies 30 years ago. But my vague recollection of that is that the second scenario that you described, basically a structured opportunity for the debtor to work its way out of debt without Well, the protections for the debtor are the ones that I think are under Article 11, and I think that's what happened in Orange County.
Right. Okay. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Snyder's recollection is a lot better than he gives himself credit for. I'm reading from the Emory Bankruptcy Development Journal 1993, which was updated even after that. The purpose of municipal bankruptcy legislation, and municipal I mean local government, is to permit a financially distressed public entity to seek protection from its creditors while it formulates and negotiates a plan for adjustments of its debts, either extending maturities, reducing interest or principal, or refinancing its debt by obtaining a new loan elsewhere to pay off existing debts in whole or in part, and to provide the mechanism by which the plan that is acceptable to the majority of the creditors can be made binding on a recalculation and dissenting minority. Basically, that's what it is. So it's a refinancing plan. It's not a liquidation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. And, Council, you're obviously I'm sorry, what was the tome that you were citing there?
This is the 9 Bankruptcy Development Journal, 621, Emory Bankruptcy Development Journal, Emory, University of Emory Law School,
thank
1993.
My question is, obviously, there are other local municipalities in the country that have this tool or device available to them, so we would not be treading new ground, and there is model legislation or statute available to take a look at what other entities, local entities, have done. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, yes, that's true. And basically what it is, it's a federal constitutional issue and federalism, and what it basically says is that state government has to authorize the local government to avail themselves of the federal bankruptcy code.
And so the mechanism here is, or the situation here is, Oregon does not have that provision available at this
Chair,
point.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an important consideration and almost seems to me to be a wake-up call on some of the issues that our local governments are facing. And I know Representative Butler talked about constraints on the tax system and maybe it's time to revisit Measure 50. And I'd just like to get a sense from Mr. Snyder and Ms. Ludwig about their sense about that, because it looks like we're talking about how we can it almost like a Band-Aid on a huge problem without looking at the underlying why did we get there question. And I'd just like a little bit from you about how you think we can, going forward, prevent things from getting worse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, this will be an issue that I think will be discussed in more depth this afternoon at 5:30, but that is one of the concerns that the counties have. That is to say that under Measures 5 and 47 and 50, that there are restraints with respect to compression and to the maximum amounts of revenues that can be generated locally, such that a number of these counties are strapped. They can't even present to their voters an opportunity to do something about it locally without some changes with respect to those provisions of the Constitution and the statutes.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger.
I want to bring us back again, because I can't recall what committee we were in, but we talked about the problem. The problem stems back to the extreme in the environmental community, when we used to have multiple use and sustained forest management. In that Curry County, 70% of it is forest land. If you were managing that county the way we have the state forest grounds for the Tillamook and Clatsop County, we'd have money running out the top of this building. And that is even taking all the endangered species issues into consideration, things we need to be doing for salmon, high-risk sites, all of that. You've got to accommodate that and still, in a very environmental satisfactory way, manage those lands. We're not doing that. But in lieu of that, they were supposed to be paying tax on that land. Now they don't want to do that. So I think the agreement's been broke, and that's why up until this happened, the counties didn't have any problem that had the timberland. They were doing real well. When I got to Curry County in 64, up through 65, 66, there were 29 people in the sheriff's office. something like 17 or 18 road deputies. Now they're down to like 4 or 5. So that's where it is. You got all this land sitting there doing nothing. Biscuit fire burn. 500,000 acres of timber standing there. Everybody twiddling their thumbs like they don't know how to do anything. We've brought this on ourselves. And until we address that, every other thing we do is a Band-Aid. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amen, amen to Representative Krieger. I couldn't have said it better. And I think that's, you know, I'm always willing to look and consider tax restructuring, but God's given us the resources here to feed and clothe and school our kids. We have a school district in the state of Oregon that gets no state money for their education system. Tillamook. It's all forest money. So we've got to be realistic in some of our actions in the state. But this is a serious situation. I didn't know about the meeting today. I'll try to schedule it. But Deschutes County, we're blessed again because we have so much other resources. We only lose about $3 million. But this has been coming, and I hope both of the organizations are going to be active in helping our eastern and southern Oregon cities and counties in this plan ahead with consolidation or whatever we can. And we continue to demand from the federal government that they pay us for the land in our counties. Deschutes County is half federally owned. So,
just to focus your thinking, committee members, recognize that the general outline of the bankruptcy laws wouldn't create any mechanism by which the counties could go after the federal government for not paying them the amount that they had undertaken to pay in the past. What it would do is it would provide an opportunity for the county, if it were in bankruptcy, to avoid performing legal obligations, pay off debts that it owes, or perform on contracts that it's undertaken. And if you look at other distressed areas, the airline industry, for example, has been in distress for a number of years, and bankruptcy has become a standard operating procedure for a number of our major airlines as a way of dealing with their cost structure, particularly their labor agreements. So understand that it's dealing with those kinds of obligations that the counties have undertaken would be at the kind of the center of a bankruptcy kind of process, and that may be part of something that needs to be out on the table. But to recognize that it's not a tool in the toolbox that will allow us to go after the feds. It's a tool in the toolbox that would enable the counties to deal with obligations that they otherwise would have to perform on.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Flores.
In the same context, however, I think the comment was, how did we get here? And I think some of that background information is helpful and helped us arrive to this critical point, tipping point, if you will. And your reference to counties being able to dismiss their debts, I think we understand that it's a reorganization, and not to eliminate their debt, but to find a way to effectively engage in paying them over time, perhaps by some reduction, yes, but not to eliminate their responsibilities, but to engage into a payment plan to meet their obligations.
Mr. Chair Krieger.
Listen, as you said, I understand what this does, but this whole issue bleeds into other things. I'm not so certain. Maybe Representative Comp would know. Those SIT counties, school districts, receive a big chunk of that money. And if they don't, I believe that money then has to come out of the rest of the formula because it doesn't support it. And so when you think that Portland isn't going to be affected, Portland will be affected. I think we're all going to be affected by what happens.
Portland already complains about
it. It'd be like the snow pot plow leveling it off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
I think Mr. Snyder had something to add.
Oh, thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, I think the principal problem and the preferred solution is with the Congress. If the Congress were to reauthorize PL 106-393 as it did 6 years ago, I think that would be the preferred approach, frankly, because most of these lands are federally owned in these counties, and you can't tax it. And there's a great deal of valuable timberland within those areas, and those harvests have sustained those counties for decades. It goes back 100 years in terms of a commitment that the federal government made in one form or another with President Theodore Roosevelt, as I recall, saying that the federal government has an obligation in terms of its ownership of these lands to assure a vibrant economy in the counties where these lands are located. And they kept that promise for decades and decades. But one of the issues, I think one of the things that we all need to focus on is that we operate a series of systems within this state, and if one piece of the system starts to crumble and fall apart, it will affect the other components of the system. And counties, for example, many of these counties, certainly more than 50% of their discretionary funds are in public safety. In Lane County, 61%. Marion County, it's 75%. And anywhere in between. And so if these counties have to take a significant cut, a big cut, and you're talking about in Curry County, about 60% of its discretionary funds would be lost. I mean, that's no small cut. And when it has to happen, it's going to happen, more than likely, in public safety, primarily. So when those things occur, the jail capacity diminishes, and the prosecutorial capacity diminishes, the roads go to pot, because a significant, about half of these funds statewide are road funds, and the rest are county discretionary funds. And so the ripple effect just starts moving out. I can tell you I saw an email from Jackson County Community Corrections to all county community corrections directors the other day saying, we're really sorry, but because of the loss of ONC funds, we're not going to be supervising misdemeanors anymore. And therefore, we're not going to accept any misdemeanors from other counties anymore. And so that's how it starts, and it's just going to ripple out across the state. So I think it would be unwise in a county that isn't directly affected to think it's not going to be affected at all, or for the state, for that matter.
Yeah. Ms. Ludwig. Here, one last comment, Linda Ludwig. As you examine the merits of this bill, you might also consider or talk with the state treasurer's office about the impact to the state bond rating. Mm-hmm. I was a county administrator with Wheeler County back in 1996 when we were going through our financial crisis pre-ballot measure 50 and looking at consolidation very seriously. State statutes about consolidation and disincorporation are fairly thorough. But one of the concerns from the state agencies and the state treasurer's office, the governor's office at that time, was the effect on the bond rating of that consolidation. You might also weigh what this bankruptcy option might do to the state's bank bond rating as you look at this bill.
It's been a good discussion, committee. I think this bill raises important issues that we need more analysis and coordination with other efforts that are being undertaken to deal with the difficult, very difficult circumstances that our counties are in. I appreciate, on an impromptu basis, both of you coming and presenting to us on it. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2463 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2457. Council Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2457 is sponsored by Representative Bruin at the request of Timothy C. Roat. Prohibits an attorney from acquiring a lien for services rendered on property in which the client has a homestead exemption. Applies only to actions commenced after the effective date of the act.
Committee members, we've been attempting to reach Representative Bruin and have been unsuccessful at finding anybody to come and present on in favor of this bill. So you've heard just a very brief summary. We do have one person signed up in opposition, Linda Johansson. Why don't you go ahead and tell us your perspective on it, since recognizing that we haven't heard anybody telling us why we ought to do this thing, but tell us why we ought not.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Linda Johansson. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm a member of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, which usually deals with issues such as this. Our section opposes House Bill 2457. What this is going to effectively do is create a blanket exemption on a homestead for only one particular kind of lien, and that's a lien created by statute for attorneys. Oregon homestead exemptions are dollar exemptions. Under ORS 18.395, a single person gets a $30,000 exemption in their homestead, and a married couple gets $39,600. In this particular bill, this will completely exempt, exempt the property from the lien of an attorney, no matter what the value of the property might be. So it singles out and discriminates against an attorney's lien that has to be made into a judgment by going through a two-step process. The attorney's lien only comes into effect if the attorney helps the client to either retain the property or acquire the property. It's my understanding that this most often occurs in domestic relations cases, and so it's the client who has the attorney keep the property, help them keep the property, and doesn't pay the attorney, who then wants to exempt that property from paying the attorney's bill. We think that the lien foreclosure process gives the client plenty of opportunities to complain about the reasonableness of the amount of the attorney's fees or whether the attorney did something wrong, and it's just bad policy to have the property completely exempted from that attorney's lien. So we urge the committee not to pass this bill out of committee.
Ms. Johansson, under what circumstances would an attorney have a lien on the home of a client?
In very limited situations, the attorney would have to represent the client on a matter, and the client doesn't pay, but the attorney has to be representing the client on the matter with regard to that property. So as I say, this usually comes up in a domestic relations claim, but in a normal civil lawsuit, representing a client on a tort claim or a money judgment type claim, you would not get an attorney's lien on that scenario.
But if an attorney were representing one party in a dissolution of marriage,
mm-hmm.
and one of the family home is one of the issues or one of the items of disposition in the divorce, then under those circumstances, the attorney would have a lien on the home. Is that the case?
The attorney will be able to assert a lien if the client gets the home in the divorce,
right,
Mr. Chairman. And then the attorney has to record the lien in the real property records and go through a process of foreclosure, which requires a lawsuit. All of that can take up to a year and a half to accomplish.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, do you have any idea how many of these type cases liens are placed a year against clients?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Krieger, I don't know the answer to that question. I understand that this is done mostly in domestic relations cases. I've never had to actually litigate it myself.
Okay, follow up. Then it could be a case where a woman, through her attorney, gets custody of the children and she's awarded the home, and her husband gets this or that, whatever. And if she didn't pay the attorney, then he would have a lien on that house. And if she can't pay it, then what's the process?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Krieger, the way it works is the attorney would record a lien against the property and then file a foreclosure action, which is just a civil lawsuit. The court would, if there's defenses to the claim, like the attorney didn't do a good job, he or she committed malpractice, whatever, all those things would be sorted out in the lawsuit, and ultimately a judgment is entered to foreclose the property. At that point in time, the sheriff becomes involved and has to do a sheriff's sale of the real property, which requires notice.
I'll follow up. Not having been through this process, so if the attorney's bill was $10,000 or $15,000 and the value of the property is $50,000, what does that person get any portion of that back, or do they just lose the property just as if you didn't pay your mortgage to the bank?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Krieger, the way it works is the property can only be sold if there's enough equity in the property to pay the homestead exemption, which, as I said earlier, was a dollar amount. And it would also be true that any mortgage lenders that have liens against the property would have to be sold. So if the property's worth $50,000, then maybe there's a $25,000 trust deed against it and a $30,000 homestead exemption. There's no value there for the attorney's lien to attach to. So the court would not authorize the sale of the property in that scenario. But with rising property values these days, it's more likely in Portland, especially, where it's worth $250,000, and maybe there's $100,000 of trust deeds against the property. There's a $30,000 homestead exemption, and there's plenty of equity beyond that to pay the attorney's lien of $15,000.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Johansson, you practice in bankruptcy law. Is a homestead exemption primarily a feature in bankruptcy law practice, a set-aside to preserve a piece of real property or a home?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, no. The bankruptcy law is, the homestead exemption is a creature of Oregon state law. Oregon has opted out of the exemptions in the bankruptcy code. And so this is something that's available in Oregon. It does often arise in bankruptcy cases where if there's no equity in the property after taking into consideration consensual liens in the homestead, then a bankruptcy trustee, for example, wouldn't even bother to try to sell the property if there's nothing there. But the homestead exemption also arises in scenarios of just money judgments. For example, if a credit card company sues somebody and gets a judgment against them, the person is entitled to claim their homestead exemption and get that cash out of the property to protect against a judgment lien for a money judgment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was the amount for the exemption established? In other words, it's hard to find a place to live for $30,000 or $39,000, especially if you have two kids. So is that, you know, should that have been elevated and then we look at this from that point of view? Or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, the dollar amount goes up on occasion. It actually just went up about 2 years ago. It used to be $25,000, so we did raise it within the last couple of years. Different states handle this differently, so Texas and Florida are fairly notorious for having an unlimited homestead exemption. California is $75,000. Oregon is $39,600 for married couple and $30,000 for single person. I think the purpose of it is to allow people to get down payment money to go reestablish a new homestead, but not to protect all of the value of their equity against their creditors.
Thank you. Members, we have a sponsor of the bill. Representative Bruin has arrived in the room. And Representative, and maybe, Mr. Johansson, you can just remain there, but Representative Bruin, could you come forward maybe to, because we haven't heard any argument in favor. We're kind of out of order here. We're hearing the reasons why this is not a good bill, but we didn't hear the reasons why it is a good bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. I appreciate the opportunity. I apologize that I'm sort of late in here. I just found out today that there actually was going to be a hearing on this. So I appreciate the fact that there is a hearing on this. I don't have the benefit of sort of hearing the testimony or the discussions that have happened beforehand. So all I can do, I can't give you any technical background on this at all. I can only tell you why this bill exists. I have a constituent that came to me at least a year ago, a Westland constituent that came to me at least a year ago, and he had been through a messy divorce proceeding. There was nothing unique about his particular situation, unfortunately. And his concern, he does just fine. He's a businessman, does just fine. His concern was that he feels
He feels that he was horribly represented in his divorce proceedings. Now, I know that can be any time an individual doesn't get the judgment they want, they can blame their attorney or they can blame the judge or everything. I mean, I know that often happens. I don't dismiss that argument, that counter-argument, if you will, as well. Nevertheless, in his particular situation, he felt that he was poorly represented and had some fairly pointed reasons why he felt he was poorly represented. And his biggest complaint wasn't necessarily the ability to go back and challenge his counsel on certain elements of his case. His biggest complaint was that while he was challenging this, his attorney had a lien on his house. He felt it wasn't a technical issue. It was completely unfair. As somebody, this particular gentleman who deals with professionals across the board, whether it's CPAs, doctors, or in this case, lawyers, he felt that in his mind, the unique ability of an attorney to file a personal lien, a lien on his personal residence, where other people in the professional world do not have that right, he felt that was unfair. And I didn't disagree with him. And so that is the one and only genesis of this bill. For what it's worth.
Thank you, Representative Bruin. I think we learned just a few minutes ago that that a lien would arise only as to sort of if the divorce proceeding awarded the home and was in effect a result of the litigation, that there wouldn't be an automatic attorney's fees lien just because he owned property. It would
right.
have to arise because
it has to be part of the settlement.
It was part of the settlement of the dissolution. And that was apparently was his situation.
That is exactly his situation.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bruin, for being here. And I have a question actually for Mr. Johansson. By way of background, could you talk a little bit about some of the remedies that Mr. Bruin's constituent would have if he believed that he was not properly represented, short of changing the lien law?
Sure. Thank Mr. you. Chair, Representative Bonamici. The attorney and the client, I guess, the remedies of the client would be to assert counterclaims in the foreclosure action for malpractice if the client thought that the attorney had mishandled the matter. There's always the availability of the court to look at the reasonableness of the fee. So if it was a fairly simple, straightforward divorce, and the bill was, $100,000, then the court might not award the full amount that the attorney is seeking. Those are the two main challenges that I can think of that the client would have.
May.
And could he bring a malpractice action against the attorney and file a complaint with the Bar Association as well?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Counsel Taylor.
And could you file a complaint with the Oregon State Bar, too?
Absolutely. There's always the arbitration process through the bar for challenging reasonableness of fees.
Any other questions? We've dragged Representative Bruin in here on short notice, so we had to put questions to him or else let him go. Representative Bonamici.
Representative Bruin, do you know if in your constituent situation did the attorney try to foreclose the lien or was the lien just filed? Or was there action?
I actually don't know. I wish I had the answer to that, and I apologize for not having the answer to that. And I think, though, in the larger scheme, just addressing the counterpoints, once again, my client is a sophisticated client. There's no question about that. I think his point was not that there's not remedies to at least an accusation, if you will, of poor counsel. Not that there's not, filing with the bar or other ways to address that. His complaint was even within those mechanisms to address this, you still have the situation of foreclosure over your head. And I think that's what his complaint about the fairness versus the unfairness and his complaint about how that doesn't seem to fit with the way we handle resolution with other professional services, whether they're CPAs or doctors or anything else.
Okay, any further questions? Representative Bruin, thank you very much for coming to this morning to help us understand this bill. And any questions for Ms. Johansson?
No.
Then we have one more witness who'd asked to testify, David Gannett. Mr. Gannett, why don't you come forward?
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, thank you so much. I'm David Gannett. I'm appearing today as a representative of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm a sole practitioner whose exclusive practice is family law, which I've been doing for 14 years. I'm also the chair of the legislative subcommittee of the Family Law Section. We are here in opposition of this bill. I'm not going to reiterate what the other witnesses have testified to as into the mechanics. I can explain to Representative Krieger if he has further questions about the practice of having the attorney's lien. Please understand in divorce cases, usually there's only two large assets, usually the retirement plan and the house, or largely the equity in the house. Also, there's an ongoing billing arrangement, which is by hourly basis. In domestic relations, we do not use lump sum fees, nor do we have a contingency. We paid hourly. So you accrue your bill as the case proceeds. Many, many times people don't have the cash flow to pay month by month as the matter goes on. And in the end, either through settlement or through the determination of a judge, the house is awarded to a particular party, or it could be ordered to be sold. The lien applies only, as you've heard already, to the party who's awarded the house at the end of the case in the judgment. We then have the attorney lien for about a year. Many times we don't exert the attorney's lien, but everyone knows it exists. And it's a negotiation tool for settling the remainder of the balance owed on the bill. It can be a payment plan. It can be a trust deed. It can be a refinance operation or operation of someone who can then use the equity in the house to pay that bill. If in the year period there's not enough equity in the house, the attorney's lien is ineffective. We can't extend the attorney's lien, and there's no reason to foreclose because you can't get anything out of the house. So what we object to is that, unlike a doctor that has insurance behind them, or even a mechanic, we do have mechanics liens and a contractor's lien, who get to lien the piece of property they actually work upon and get payment of their services, the attorney's lien acts the same way in a dissolution matter. So it's basically a long-standing practice to use attorney liens. It's an equitable arrangement that has a limited period of operation that we can use to collect the balance of the fee. So for those reasons, we oppose this bill.
Any questions, Kate? Thank you, Mr. Gannett.
Thank you, Chair.
Before Mr. Gannett, Mr. Chair, I realized Representative Krieger wanted to know how often these are used, the attorney's liens in family law cases. Do you have any sense of that?
I can't, Representative McPherson, Representative Mannucci. I can't give you numbers, but let me explain from my practice. I will do 20 to 30 divorces a year. The house is relevant in nearly all of them. The attorney's lien is an acknowledged part of the, if there's an outstanding bill, of that it's out there. And so when we talk to our clients, we're always talking about, well, what is the option? Refinancing. A lot of times family members, in the case of the example that Representative Krieger worked with, where there's a woman who's getting a house, a lot of times the family members will look at, can we help refinance within that year? And that's one of the things that the lenders are going to look at, is the year following the divorce, is there a possibility of doing the refinancing? So do we actually exercise the attorney lien in those 20 or 30 cases? Very rarely, but it's part of the dynamics of how are we going to resolve this outstanding balance in the year of time that we have available. I know there's many firms in the Portland area, the Tri-Metro, three-county area, that, yes, attorney's liens are used constantly.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gannett.
Thank you.
That concludes the public hearing on House Bill 2457. I will close that public hearing, and that concludes our agenda for today. Committee, thank you very much for your attendance. We're adjourned.